Greetings, friends. Welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the film review podcast where we review films.
We do that sometimes.
We don't need a catchphrase, that we just review movies. My name is Whitney Seibold. I am a film critic of no renown whatsoever. And with me, as always, is a renowned film critic.
You are a deeply respectable human being who inspires joy feelings in all those around you. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs. I'm honored to be here with Whitney Seibold, my partner of many, 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 many years in the podcasting business.
With the power of joy feelings, it seems.
Yeah. And this week on Critically Acclaimed, we are reviewing a whole bunch of new movies, including David Cronenberg's Crimes of the Future, the thriller Watcher, the thriller Dashcam, the romantic comedy Fire Island, the action movie Interceptor, and the action movie RRR.
I call it triple R.
I don't know. I didn't see that one, so I can't speak to it. So I don't know.
Some people are just like making a rolling R sound, like.
Ah, well, it's three. Yeah. It's three words, right?
Yeah, each R stands for a different word.
So it'd be just R.
It's a pirate movie.
Well, we'll talk about that when the time comes. By the way, elephant in the room, we realized that unless you were a Patreon over at patreon.com/CriticallyAcclaimedNetwork, we actually released quite a few episodes less than usual last week. No grander story to that. We had some people reach out to us, say, are you guys okay? It was a rough week scheduling-wise, and we just couldn't find the time to get together and do our regular stuff, so.
And there were some nights when we were free, but then it was, like, far too late to record.
Yeah, or, like, one of us said, like,
sort of crapped out on each other.
Yeah, it's rough when you're an adult, and this, unfortunately, as much as we love this, and it seems like we spend all our time doing it, this is not actually our day job, for the most part, so we do have to find the time whenever we can, and usually we're better about it, but last week was rough. We're back at it, though. We released an episode about Cactus Flower yesterday, and today we're back with new movie reviews, and I am very excited to talk about any new movie from David Cronenberg. David Cronenberg is one of my favorite filmmakers. David Cronenberg is a generally very exciting filmmaker. Not without his duds. Not everything he's done has been brilliant. But his hits are so distinctive and interesting and thoughtful and exciting and creepy and weird that I'm willing to forgive the occasional whoopsie-daisy.
Yeah, well, what's the big whoopsie-daisy?
Big whoopsie-daisy.
I didn't say see Maps to the Stars, that's a whoopsie-daisy, which I've heard was not a good one.
That's a whoopsie-daisy.
I was fond of Cosmopolis, but I know a lot of people don't like Cosmopolis.
Real fast, David Cronenberg is a Canadian filmmaker who's been making films since the 1970s. His work was initially in the more of the sci-fi horror realm.
Like, a little bit more aggressively so. Like, a lot more violent I don't want to say conventionally horrific, but directly scary. Like,
I would say unconventionally horrific in a lot of ways. He was very, very, very interested in the concepts in science fiction and horror from a medical perspective, from the perspective of the human body and how it connects to the human mind. And, you know, if you did indeed have, like, a creepy parasite that made you do terrible things, well, okay, that would be scary, but what if I made it like a medical film? What if I made it, because doctor's offices make people freak out anyway. Yeah, like, they scare me. So he that approach that he had, and even his remake of The Fly, which is arguably his best, or at least one of his best movies, you know, Jeff Goldblum gene splices himself with a fly by accident, and he finds himself becoming fascinated by what happens to his body.
Yeah, like he pulls pieces off of himself and keeps them in jars.
Yeah, he becomes almost obsessed with how he's physically deteriorating, and that's a very distinctive take on that. It's really brilliant.
Cronenberg has always been very interested in disease and decay. If it's not decay of the body, it's a kind of mental decline that also coincides with it, kind of a decay of one's surroundings. You'll notice that his movies tend to begin in very clean, shiny environments, in some cases.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
And they always end in, like, a dilapidated apartment that's, like, burnt out and full of, like, litter and filth.
Dead Ringers is an excellent example of this. But you can even see this
in Videodrome, in Crash.
You can even see this in some of his, like, maybe less typical films, like his adaptation of M. Butterfly.
Mm-hmm.
Actually begins and ends a very similar way, now that you think about it. Yeah, he's interested in decline, and sometimes it's mental, sometimes it's physical, usually it's a combination of both. And again,
well, it's about neglect of one over the other, typically.
I'd say a connection most of the time, yeah. Honestly.
Well, exactly. You neglect yeah. one and the other falls away, and so yeah. you try to... There's no balance in a lot of these films. It's kind of... I'm surprised he didn't get to Freud and Jung earlier in his career than he did. He made a film called A Dangerous Method, which is about... It's based on a play, and it's about Freud and Jung and their relationship.
And I would actually argue it's maybe his to date, anyway, his last, like, truly great film. Like, it's a really excellent... It got a little overlooked come award season, so some people disregarded it, but well, it's a fantastic motion picture.
Also, David Cronenberg doesn't tend to get a lot of awards attention because his films are very off-putting and cerebral.
Yeah.
That's just sort of his milieu. That's how he works.
I remember when Dead Ringers came out. Dead Ringers stars Jeremy Irons and Jeremy Irons as identical twin gynecologists who
they're trying to get their parents back together at summer camp.
God. I would pay to see that movie so bad. You have no idea how much it would pay to see Dead Ringers.
Freaky Friday with
really
Jeremy
Freaky
Irons.
Friday. No, you're thinking of Parent Trap. But they play twin gynecologists, and one is extroverted, one is introverted, and they decide to share lovers. Like, he will seduce them, and then they'll switch places so that his introverted brother. It's a very creepy thing in and of itself. But over time, they become truly obsessive, and the lines between them start blurring. And Jeremy Irons gives such an immaculate performance, and it's all done with editing. There's not a lot of like trick photography where you can see like
there's a couple,
Haley Mills opposite Haley
I think
Mills.
There's a couple shots where they're in the frame
they're
together.
They're very, very careful about it. It is not, you just, but the performance is so strong that you don't even notice. And if that was your first introduction to Jeremy Irons, you'd probably think there were two of them. You'd probably think he was identical twin actors. Like, that's how good he is. That movie got so much acclaim for Jeremy Irons' performance that a lot of people thought it was going to win the Academy Award for Best Actor. He wasn't nominated, perhaps because the movie was so off-putting. He did end up winning the year after that for a film called Reversal of Fortune, which is also a great film with a really great performance.
Uh-huh.
But generally speaking, it's one of those times where people are just like, he won for Dead Ringers.
You know what? He is genuinely great in Reversal of Fortune.
I love him. People, nobody talks about him. Right?
Reversal of Fortune is really, it's a true story about Klaus von Bülow, and look him up. He's got a very
very famous court case.
Interesting court case. David Cronenberg, he resents the phrase body horror. He doesn't like that his films are so typically described that way.
You should probably stop making them that way then.
I suppose so.
I mean, it's an apt description. Like, I don't mean it negatively. I hope he doesn't take it personal, but like, you make horror about the body, damn it.
He hasn't made a horror or science fiction film since the movie Existenz in 1999. All of his films since then.
Not purely, no.
Because immediately after that, he sort of moved into the Spider, Eastern Promises, the films he made with Viggo Mortensen kind of realm. And
Viggo Mortensen wasn't in Spider, but yeah, fair enough.
But yeah.
In fact, Spider's really good, by the way. Nobody talks about
Spider. He made with Ralph Fiennes, and Ralph Fiennes was actually supposed to be the star of Crimes of the Future.
Oh,
but
no
could,
shit.
I think there was a scheduling problem.
I hadn't heard that. That's interesting.
Viggo Mortensen came in instead.
Anyway, for like the last 20 years or so, David Cronenberg has kind of eschewed the stuff that he was kind of most famous for, these kind of bizarre horror sci-fi hybrids, and made a few straightforward thrillers, some very intellectual thrillers, some very heady films about like society and fame and the economy, and to varying degrees of success. You like Cosmopolis more than I do, but I do think it's very, very good. I would argue...
That's his Occupy Wall Street movie. Yeah. He really kind of delves into financial injustice, and even then says it's like this weird symptom of the body. Most of the film takes place inside a car, like in the back of a limo, and there's all this action going on outside the window.
It's almost like it's Cocoon.
It's like really brilliantly filmed because it's mostly in the car. And there's this really bizarre scene in Cosmopolis where he's getting his physical from his doctor in the back of the limousine, while he's taking a meeting with someone else. So it's like, his car and the body, they're all kind of like one and the same, and he kind of starts experiencing all of this weird kind of mental decay over the course of the movie, and it's all just because of wealth. Money is the thing that's kind of robbed him of his sense of self.
Yeah, but anyway, a lot of my favorite movies are David Cronenberg movies. Dead Ringers, The Fly, his early horror film Shivers, I think is one of the scarier movies ever made. Existenz is really, really brilliant.
As well,
You know, and many more besides.
A lot of people know him for The Fly. They know him for Videodrome, which is one of my favorites.
You're a bigger fan than I am, but it is excellent. Yeah.
And
the exploding head scene from Scanners.
Scanners, that was the other one. I was
even if the rest of the nobody remembers the rest of the movie, just the exploding that head exploding scene head. Is enough, and it's a hell of a scene.
They made a rubber head and then they stuck a shotgun up inside of it and they just blew it up.
It's incredible. But I do think that he is not infallible, and I would argue that his Hollywood his send-up of like how just alienated Hollywood is from the human experience, maps of the stars is, I think, largely unsuccessful. I don't think it really amounts to much other than it's kind of weird, isn't it? I would argue Fast Company is an interesting tone poem about like stock car racing. It's kind of one of the weirder films in his canon.
It was one of his earlier movies.
He had an interest in something else. He tried it out. It's not a bad movie per se, but it's also not particularly interesting. And I would actually argue, unfortunately, that his new film, Crimes of the Future, is not great.
Well, David Cronenberg has never been a very welcoming filmmaker. He's not letting you in. And in fact, a lot of themes you'll find in a lot of his movies, it's in Videodrome, it's in Cosmopolis, it's very much a big part of Naked Lunch, and it's one of the centerpieces of Crimes of the Future, is a shadowy government conspiracy of some kind. That there's this sense of paranoia, that there's this force out there willing to get you. But Cronenberg never ever describes the true nature of these conspiracies.
He's not super interested in it, honestly. Like these, it's just this general sense that like the world is unwelcoming.
Yeah, like these two people will drift in and says, ah, yes, we're from Interzone Corp. And Interzone's Naked Lunch. And
it's like that scene in Invader Zim. I am government man, here from the government.
Yeah, more or less. And they say, we're here to do something really horrible to your body, like in Videodrome. We're going to insert a video cassette into your abdomen, and then we're going to vanish for a big
and
part of the
Betamax,
movie.
And it's Betamax, so it's extra evil.
And you'll get these weird messages through these other intermediaries whose identity you also don't really know. To commit these acts of violence. And after a while, it starts to feel like you're going a little bit crazy.
Yeah, it feels like a paranoid delusion.
Yeah. And that's a big part of Crimes of the Future. And unfortunately, those elements don't necessarily stand in the way if he also has something that he's kind of getting at. That there's this weird kind of government conspiracy that disapproves of whatever it is the main character is doing. Videodrome is a commentary on media.
Oh, yeah.
Crash is a commentary on sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
Crimes of the Future, I'm not exactly sure what he's getting at this time.
I'm frustrated because I thought I had it.
Okay.
And I was enjoying this movie for the first half of it. And then it seemed abundantly clear that either he lost interest in whatever he was doing and decided to go off another direction, and it was kind of half-baked, underdeveloped, and didn't go anywhere. Or what I thought he was doing was never what he thought he was doing, and what he thought he was doing was opaque and not very interesting, which is frustrating. Crimes of the Future, just let's get a baseline here. Crimes of the Future stars
the premise of the movie.
It stars Viggo Mortensen as an artist and a performance artist in the near-ish future. And in the nearish future, humanity is undergoing a bizarre form of unwilling evolution.
Well, he's affected with this condition where he's growing brand new internal organs.
Yeah.
Not tumors, but new organs. And not doubles of the ones he has. New ones, and they don't know what they do.
Yeah.
And his artistic partner is played by Léa Seydoux. Uses these devices to sort of like reach into his abdomen with these tubes and put tattoos on those organs.
Mm-hmm.
And then their performance art is he'll lay in this big sort of carapace looking, it's like an autopsy machine. It's got like blades on these little automated arms.
Imagine if H.R. Geiger designed a sarcophagus with knives in it.
And they call it like a Sarco, like it's
got like a brand name.
Yeah, a brand name sarcophagus. Yeah.
And so like they remove so it they, in public in front of other people as a form of performance art.
This is the near future, and there's been at some point in the past some kind of big widespread genetic drift that has eliminated physical pain for most people.
Yeah.
So people are just slicing into themselves and doing surgery in the street because they don't feel any pain, and now that's sort of the new form of art. And indeed, they say this in the movie, it's the new sex.
Mm-hmm.
You know, instead of having sex, you have surgery.
Yeah, and Viggo Mortensen is at the forefront of this new art form. He is considered a titan of it, an outsider perhaps, not necessarily commercial. There's a great bit where he goes to see another person's art show, and the art show is a guy with like dozens of ears all over his body.
His eyes and mouth are sewn shut, but he has covered with ears.
Yeah, and they're not prosthetics, they're like genetically implanted or surgically implanted. And later on, someone asks him, how was the show? And he just rolls his eyes and he just says, escapist propaganda, which is hilarious.
That's kind of cute.
And honestly, like at that point, I'm starting to realize like that's this whole chunk of the movie where like he has to go to like the new genetic organ like registration board in order to register his new organs with the government. And because
what he has is now like... It's widespread, even though we're not talking about it too much. Right. So now they have to register whatever new organs grow in.
Well, because they're concerned about people evolving into bizarre directions, and maybe we need to catalog this and potentially put a stop to it. But the people who work there, including Kristen Stewart, giving her Nicolas Cage-iest performance.
Every single line reading she does is like a little sideways.
Yeah, I've heard some people say she's giving a bad performance, and I was thinking about this. I'm like, if Nicolas Cage was giving this performance, you would love it.
No, it's
like she's
wonderful. She's
really interesting.
She's actually like the only element of this movie that has like a little bit of levity.
Well, there's the two queer sarcophagus repair people hitmen who I think are having fun, but that's a whole side thing. We'll get to that. We'll get to that shit. That's
weird,
a different
thing. Element of gratuitous nudity. With
but
those
in any case,
he's
a famous artist. People look up to him. They admire him. He goes to register his organs with the government, and they're like all over his shit, and they like want to like archive his organs and everything. And I'm starting to realize that Viggo Mortensen is playing David Cronenberg. This is David Cronenberg as an aging outsider artist who has a lot of clout, a lot of fan persons, has to put up with a lot of people talking about what his material is. There's a great bit where one of his groupies tries to have sex with him, and he's just incredibly awkward about it. I was watching this with my partner, Michelle, and the whole bit where he's like going to the Canadian Film Board, the Organ Registration Board, and they're like fawning over him and trying to get him to do like a public appearance and everything like that. And my partner turned to me and they said, this is what David Cronenberg goes through at film festivals. And probably, I think it's this kind of commentary on like how his career has evolved, how people look at his career, and how he himself is looking back in his career in the contemporary age, and now that things are evolving in odd directions. And on that level, I was really, really into it. But then the second half becomes this weird conspiracy crime thing with a guy who may have developed a way for human beings to start eating plastic.
Scott Speedman plays that character and wants to barter a human body for use in art shows. And
in order to reveal his grand design and maybe
plastic eating underground movements. And the thing is, I don't understand where the paranoia is coming from in this story.
What are we supposed to be afraid of here?
The registration office is trying to book all of these new organs and put them on the books, and because it's a Cronenberg movie, everything's really low tech.
It's a lot of filing cabinets,
brown interiors. It looks like rooms you don't want to stay in. And they say, there's a lot of concern about people evolving too quickly. Why? What's the concern? What is being gained and what is being lost? Because we don't get a bigger picture as to sort of the world that we live in, which Cronenberg doesn't do anyway.
No, it's actually weirdly abstract. You don't know what country we're in. You don't know, like, you don't even know what time it is, like what era it is.
I think they don't say it, but it's Greece.
It looks like that kind of a country, but it's hard to say.
So this sort of conspiracy.
A lot of history to it.
And now there's all of this like cover up as to like cover up what these new organs mean and what is the next step for human evolution.
But we were talking about art for like 45 minutes and now we're doing act. It feels like this was a metaphor that became too literal and now we're only talking about it literally. It's kind of like what happened to like Star Wars, where it's like it used to be a fun little allegory and now a reference to something else. And now it's got to be like everything's got to be about the thing itself. And I'm just like, David, how did you do that in one movie? Like, it's really kind of incredible.
There's a few things I do like about this. I do actually like that weird sort of sense of paranoia that sort of floats through his movies. I love his aesthetic. That kind of muted brown, really kind of subdued universe that the these things exist in. David Cronenberg, although he himself is really interested in like shiny high tech stuff, mm-hmm. and he's talked about how digital projection and digital photography is way better than old school, old world film. Mm-hmm. It's easier to edit. He was always in favor of people going to their going onto their DVDs and watching scenes of movies out of order,
yeah.
because you can kind of like clip around and do editing yourself.
Yeah.
I haven't finished it yet, but I started reading his novel, Consumed.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Which, yeah. I heard that's got some parallels with this movie, actually.
A little bit, yeah. That's a movie about a really rare sexually transmitted disease, and the person it was named after, and these eccentric murderers who are also connected to the disease in this way. But I lost my train of thought.
His interest in high technology,
and in that right. book, he talks a lot about like the computers they're using and talking over FaceTime and how this is just sort of a natural way to communicate. And yet you go into his movies and none of that is in there. In fact, yeah. people don't even wear jewelry in his movies.
I feel like that's a calculated attempt to make his movies feel timeless by not making them feel contemporary.
Maybe so. I think it's just an aesthetic he's fond of.
Well, I think that's why.
There's Viggo Mortensen, for instance, sleeps in this gigantic, it looks like a beetle shell. It's like yeah. full of pillows. And it like has yeah. these tendrils that reach down and reach into the wounds on his body to alleviate the pain. Because he does feel pain.
He feels pain
but
when
only
he's
when he's asleep. Yeah. So he needs to sleep in this big special.
So the idea is that he's subconsciously feeling things even though he's dead inside as a conscious person, and then he is perhaps subconsciously deciding what organs to make, and that is somehow part of the process. And again, it feels like he's saying something about creativity and how he views creativity, but then it becomes like literally about like, and then this person's an undercover spy for the art critic cops. Like, literal art critic cops.
So there's a lot going on here. It's a criticism of the high art world. And I feel like, more than anything, it's a send-up of high art. And I would love to get the line on Cronenberg's own exposure to the high art world and figure out who he was, like, who in particular he was sending up. Because I feel like he's probably met art, like, performance artists or artists who are a lot like this. Cronenberg is one of those filmmakers who doesn't, even though his films are very cerebral, doesn't like to talk about his movies, like analyze them with other people.
He doesn't want to hand them to you on a platter.
And here's the weird thing, he used to. I've read older interviews with him, and he's actually very open about what he's trying to say with his movies, and now he doesn't do that anymore, because he's in his late 70s and he doesn't have to.
Yeah, I care.
Making this movie was sort of a breeze for him, because an actor comes to a Cronenberg film at this point, they just do what he says.
He doesn't have to explain.
It's like, you're going to be in a Cronenberg movie. I'm going to be in a Cronenberg movie.
Yeah.
Okay, you want me to hide a body? Sure.
Yeah.
I trust you. I liked that detail. I liked the a little bit more of sort of the horrific things. Because Viggo Mortensen has all these new organs, he has trouble eating. He can't digest food regularly, so he has to sit in these weird digestion chairs.
Yeah.
I feel like the special effects were supposed to be a little bit more elaborate, because they just sort of like tilt back and forth and squeeze your abdomen with these little kind of bony insect arms.
Yeah, it looks almost like one of those like 4D... like movie theater chairs,
like
just like shake you around when like, oh shit, Maverick's really flying around now. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and you sit in that while you eat, and that's supposed to help food go through your system.
Yeah, I what I like about the movie, and ultimately, I think this is not a successful film. I think he loses the thread. I think there are things in the second half of the movie that just simply make no sense. I have no idea why those two people killed that guy. Like, I literally don't know. Like, I don't think the movie does either.
Who they were working for, why they were killing this guy.
But if they think, okay, maybe they killed that guy for this reason. But then why did they kill that guy? He had nothing to do with it. Are they just like assassin temps just sort of wandering around and doing things on spec? What are they doing here?
And like, there's no sense as to what it means for the lid to be blown off of all of
this. We don't know what the lid means for the lid to be blown off of this. We don't understand, like, there's a whole scene where, like, we are exposed to someone's, like, internal organs, and it's like, this is all wrong. And I'm like, we don't know what it was supposed to look like. We're not giving context here. There's a lot of talk about, like, who is requesting and inspiring and benefiting from the art that some of these people are making, for example. But what this movie is weirdly devoid of, and I think it prevents the film from having a lot of teeth is any sense of what the class system is like. Like, for example, Scott Speedman plays a character who ostensibly, he's in charge of stuff. He has a big business. He's, like, leading a group of people. But for half the movie, I literally thought he was homeless. Like, and then it turns out he's actually...
He's, like, living in a flop house.
But then it turns out he's got all of these resources and everything. And I'm like,
they introduce the character by saying he's, like, this rich industrialist.
Really well. It's not clear. Like, it's... We don't see it in, like, his house or anything like that. Without seeing, like, who benefits from all of these schemes, it's really difficult to really say what this satire or what this critique is really aimed at. Mm. And the only thing that really hits are these sort of whimsical analogs to Cronenberg, like, meeting someone from film Twitter. You know, like, and all of those moments are really funny and interesting, and they're infused with a lot of great thought, and there's so much good stuff in it, but it just loses its focus and becomes a weird, confusing mishmash towards the end. I spent a lot of time trying to think about, what am I missing here? Like, what is... Mm. Surely he thought of... And I have come up with some, like, theories, but none of them track all the way through. There's always something missing that would keep it from truly landing. And I can't really talk about all of them without, like, discussing, like, the ending, which I feel... is one of those endings where it's just like, okay, great, now the third act is about to start, it's the credits, oh my god, we're just ending right there.
Like, we just figured out, like, something important about one of these characters.
I thought this is where it's going to kick in, that, and we're going to make, and we're going to finally make our point, and then it turns out, no, like, oh god, alright, well, this feels like David Cronenberg's did some sketches. You know, or maybe, like, wrote a first draft.
Hmm. He had a couple of ideas and just tried to put them together.
Yeah, which, again, you're entitled to do. It's certainly more interesting than a lot of successful movies that I've seen. But it's also, I can't really in good conscience recommend it. Certainly it's not one of his better works. Well,
another really upsetting thing about Crimes of the Future is, you know, this is about surgery, and they talk about body horror, and there's all these interesting tools that they're using to reach into people's bodies. It's weirdly not disturbing. Like, watching the surgery scenes don't give you any kind of, like, icky, unsettled feeling.
It's actually considered kind of sexy.
It's very presented very matter-of-factly. Yeah. It's almost neutral. Yeah. And there's a scene...
Well, which leads to maybe my interpretation that he's an artist who's been working for a long time and it's a little dull now.
Yeah, but you know? I think a lot of the idea is people are doing these sort of, like, body modifications as performance art, and indeed there's several scenes of body modification throughout the
from different artists,
different characters throughout the movie, and that doesn't have any kind of, like, mounting momentum, like, we're gonna body alter ourselves until the point where we don't even look human anymore, like,
it's a promise that the movie doesn't really want to
Seems like it's going to go someplace really kind of disturbing and grotesque, and it never gets grotesque, and that's upsetting.
And again,
I wanted it to be grotesque.
I feel like part of the commentary is, here's so much potential here, you can do literally anything, and people are just like, more ears, go with it. And even like the protagonist is kind of like rolling his eyes at it, like, you can literally do anything with the human body, and just gave him more ears, why?
Yeah,
what are we saying with this?
And there, like, should have been a scene later on to counter that. Like,
we need contrast.
We recreated the final scene from Society in live action. Wouldn't that be keen?
Yeah, well, and again, you know, again, I just feel like it's missing contrast. Mm. The contrast is necessary in order to determine what in this movie is deemed to, even at least to the characters, have value, to have meaning, to have... to warrant moral judgment. There's a big moral judgment that's made at the end of the movie. I'm still hazy on...
why it's wrong.
Well, I mean, it's clearly weird and messed up, but, like, seriously, like, are we gonna... Why all of a sudden are we getting on a pedestal about it? Because I feel like we're kind of all kind of guilty of this shit, and we're not really talking about that, and then the movie's over. There's also this whole series... we'll move on. But there's this weird series of scenes between... Viggo Mortensen and, like, this, like, cop character, and I'm not going to tell you how all that comes together. It literally feels like all of those scenes left out of the movie completely, and they were all added. It feels like they're all added to explain stuff that was obtuse Or like kind of, it's literally just, so wait, what happened just now? And Viggo Mortensen's like, oh, this stuff happened. And then the cop's just like, oh yeah, well, it turns out this person did that. And I'm like, cool, does that mean anything? And could we have seen it? And could it matter later or even now? And the answer to that is no, none of those things.
Viggo Mortensen's a very good actor.
He can do a lot.
He can be very funny, he can be very lighting, very serious. He usually takes some sort of like... he's cast in like heavier kind of roles.
He's a big guy, square jaw. I remember when he played the drill instructor in G.I. Jane. Like he's a big tough guy. Well, he's Aragorn. He's a big warrior type looking guy. You know,
He's cast as like a warrior in a Lord of the Rings movie. Yeah. I don't know what he's doing here. He's supposed to be like growing these new organs, and he's always like a little bit uncomfortable. But he, in order to sort of cover his body, because his body is his instrument, so he wants to cover it up. So he wears this kind of big shadowy-looking raincoat.
He looks like a Sith Lord.
I suppose it's just like a raincoat, but he's covered up. We don't see his face a lot. We don't see his mouth a lot, and he kind of is always straining to get his dialogue out, and I couldn't understand him a lot of the time.
Oh, weird.
So there was a lot...
Maybe, I didn't have that problem. Maybe it was
your
theater.
Maybe, there's something about the sound in my theater. It was like, you're inside the organs. Yeah, there's this conspiracy. Okay.
I mean, he's raspy. He's playing it like he's physically diminished.
I know, but if you're going to give me all these like oblique terms, I'd rather hear them. It would be nice if there was a little bit more just aural clarity.
Yeah.
But just as a weird technical note, but
Anyway, moving on, let's talk about another thriller that opened this weekend. This is a serial killer thriller called Watcher, starring the great Micah Monroe.
Micah Monroe is pretty cool.
Micah Monroe is increasingly like one of the best horror actors I think we've got.
She, at the very least, has excellent taste in projects.
Yeah.
Because she was also in The Guest, and she was also in It Follows, and those are both rather notable horror films from the last couple of years.
And although this isn't quite as striking as those other movies, it's also very, very good. This is a movie from director Chloe Okuno, and Micah Monroe plays a woman who moves to Romania with her husband. He gets a new job. He was born there but raised in America. He knows the language. She doesn't, so she's very much a fish out of water. He has to translate everything, and she has to sort of trust that he's translating correctly. Sometimes it seems like people have a private little joke, but he doesn't explain it to her. She has nothing to do here. At least not yet. She hasn't. She has to figure out what she's going to do while she's here, because she's moved for her spouse's career. And she is all alone in this really gigantic apartment. And when I mean gigantic, I don't mean like a whole bunch of rooms. I mean weirdly tall.
It's like a studio apartment.
It's like, but like a giant.
Like a loft apartment.
Like a loft apartment. Mm-hmm. Like seriously, like the
studio loft.
Like, I'd say, how tall is a typical like ceiling? What, like what, 9 feet, 10 feet, something like that? This one feels like it's at least 15. Like, it's just weirdly big. And they have these giant windows, and when she looks outside, she can see other apartment complexes, and she sees the lights from everyone's windows, and she's just looking outside because, again, nothing else to do. And she keeps seeing one guy in one apartment who is just constantly staring at her. Not moving, just staring at her. And it's fucking creepy. And she tries to tell her husband about this, and he doesn't find it remarkable. He doesn't think it's worth noting. He thinks, okay, well, let that guy do his own thing, and why don't we just shut these blinds and never talk about it? But it also turns out that there's a serial killer in the neighborhood.
Someone
who's slicing throats, increasingly like decapitating them more and more every single time. And Micah Monroe is concerned because some creepy guy is watching her, and she's not 100% sure, but she's pretty convinced someone is also following her around town, like to the movies or in the grocery store. And she keeps trying to tell her husband and the cops, I'm concerned for my safety. Someone is watching me. And after making a few very passive interrogations into that, everyone basically agrees she's making a mountain out of a molehill and completely ignoring her. So as you can imagine...
It's a good paranoia, nobody listens to me kind of...
Well, and specifically nobody listens to women, which is pretty significant here. There's a scene early on which is indicative of the entire film, where, you know, they've just moved to Romania. It's their first night, and he's going to go to work the next day and leave her all alone, which is, she can handle. She's an adult, but, like, you know, she wants to say goodbye to him in the morning. And she says, wake me up before you go. Simple request.
Before you go?
But yes.
All right.
Don't leave her hanging on like a yo-yo. Says, Mrs., wake me up before you leave for work. And we cut to, like, midday, she wakes up, and she's got a message on her phone, and the message is, you were so cute, I couldn't wake you up, and I took a picture of you sleeping. Which just goes to show, like...
Shades of Lost Highway. There.
Yeah, which is also just, like, again, this is just, you can't even, like, respect her enough to do a little thing, like, that she asks you to do.
Yeah.
Instead, you choose to regard her. And... that's the movie in a nutshell. It's just people ignoring women when they say there are red flags, there are dangers. And it builds to actually, I think, a very effective climax. I feel like if this movie were made in the 1970s, it would have been made by, like, Dario Argento or Umberto Lenzi or something. Oh, yeah. And it would have had a lot more murders in it. The murders would have been a lot more vivid. But it also would have undermined...
stylish.
Yeah, yeah, but and it would have been more exciting and more suspenseful, but it also would have undermined the premise. I think if you luxuriate in the violence against women, then the story about, like, why men should take women more seriously when they accuse men of wrongdoing... would kind of fall apart a little bit because we're supposed to enjoy that violence in some way.
Right.
So here, it's actually much more of a reserved movie. It does go somewhere. I'm not going to say exactly where it goes. And there's a really creepy bit with a plastic bag I'm not going to ruin.
It really is dancing. Like, it's begging me to play with it.
Shut up. Not American Beauty creepy. Like, legitimately. Sorry. No, like legitimately. Like, I don't know. Like, I don't know if it was a trick. Like, they were convincing me to, like, project onto that bag a shape that it doesn't have. All or right. If they carefully molded this bag to look a certain way, like it carried something really freaky in it. Like, cool. I don't know, but, like, they nailed it. Like, it's super disturbing. So there's really good, like, bits in it. But it is a little reserved and a little dry. And as a result, it really does fall in almost entirely on Micah Monroe to keep the movie alive. She's got to be vulnerable, but also strong enough that we think she might be able to get out of this. Mm-hmm. You know, she's got to really have this incredible balancing act where, I'm sorry, she nails it. She's so damn good. She's, like, absolutely, like, the perfect protagonist for this kind of thriller. She brings, like, so much to even a role with, like, very little dialogue. That I'm just increasingly a fan. I want to see more and more and more. I feel like she's one of those actors who, you know, they started off doing some really exciting indies and It Follows and The Guest, and then they had, like, their big breakout, like, blockbuster movie they got cast in, but then that was Independence Day Resurgence.
That's right.
and nobody came out of that movie looking good. Like, I wasn't nearly as angry at that movie as other people were, but, like, nobody did especially good in it. Like, nobody shined.
It's a pretty terrible movie.
Yeah. And, but it's not even this, like, oh, well, at least there was one breakout performance. Like, no, it's just everyone just sunk under this weird franchise, like, reboot. But so I feel like they missed that spot. She needs more. She's so talented that she carries this whole movie, and I think the movie works mostly because she's good in it. But it's pretty good. Okay. It's not amazing, but it's pretty good. What isn't pretty good, and I'm going to make this quick because I actually haven't seen this recently. I saw this movie last year. It was remotely, but it was for a film festival. And it's not fresh in my mind. So I'm going to give you a quick...
But it comes out this
week. It came out this last weekend. Yeah. It is a movie called Dash Cam. And it is the latest film from Rob Savage, who wrote and... I forget if he co-wrote it. But he directed the quarantine thriller Host.
It's really quite good.
Which is really quite excellent. It made it really early on in the quarantine, too. As soon as everyone was really, like, housebound... Rob Savage got some actors together, and he came up with a movie that was about people who decided to join together for an online seance, and how they release something supernatural that's going to kill them, but
in each of their homes.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's actually like, and that's a clever idea in and of itself, but he actually manages to make it kind of a commentary on how people who don't take life or death situations seriously are getting everyone killed. It was perfectly topical and a legitimately great horror movie. And so I was excited to see more from him. And unfortunately, his follow-up is quite bad.
Oh, that's too bad.
Is a film, it is another, it's a found footage horror film.
I really dug Host.
I dug it too.
It's really good.
I appreciate, I think he's going for something here. I don't think it works, but, are you familiar with an indie rock band called Giant Drag?
No, I don't know Giant Drag.
So there's the lead singer and guitarist and songwriter for it is a person named Annie Hardy. Annie Hardy stars in this movie basically as herself. I don't know how closely she's playing herself because I don't know her and I don't really know her music, but in the movie she plays a woman, and she is a MAGA enthusiast, online troll. All
right.
Believes that the pandemic is all a sham. Goes full Karen in restaurants. Like, she's just incredibly
the worst of humanity.
It kind of is, and unintentionally so. Obviously, the movie obviously knows that she's not a good person.
Yeah.
She hosts an online show where she's driving around town while she is live streaming, and the people who are watching her give her random words, and she incorporates it into an ongoing freeform rap about everything she sees, which is kind of interesting, but not really a movie. She decides in the middle of the pandemic to go visit her friend in England, I believe. They used to be in a band together. He is now married, or at least in a serious relationship with someone who has absolutely no patience for her, has no meaningful relationships with her, and is unwilling to forgive her for any of her bullshit. She is shrill, cruel, annoying, irresponsible, and when they basically try to kick her out, she decides to take his car and his, like, Uber Eats route and just go around and picking up other people's food. And when she does, someone comes up to her and just says, "Here's a bunch of money. I have a person here who is strangely not talking and seems physically afflicted with some kind of ailment and occasionally excretes horrifying things. Would you mind delivering them for me?" And for whatever reason, and for the money, she says, "Sure." And then, sure enough, this person in her backseat is perhaps possessed by a demon or an alien or something. And it ends up going
growing new organs.
Yeah, and then ends up going really, really bad for her and everyone she comes in contact with. It is never entirely clear what exactly supernaturally is going on. It is never satisfyingly vague in that kind of horror movie way where, like, okay, I don't have all the answers, but I know it's creepy. You know, like, that kind of thing. It's never that either. It's just confusing and unmotivated and dissatisfying, and we are trapped in a car with the worst person you know on the internet. The absolute worst person who has ever commented on one of your tweets is now the star of a movie, and you're stuck with them, and they're the protagonist, and every single thing they say or do gets other people hurt. Somewhat disproportionately people of color, I might add. I'm hoping that's an accident because it doesn't really seem like it's thematically really addressed in a meaningful way. Clearly they made a choice. It was like, what if we did a horror movie and the protagonist was the worst person in the world?
Is it possible to feel sympathy for the horrible person?
And the answer to that is yes. Like, you look at, like, Tales from the Crypt episodes where, like, someone is really, really terrible, but their comeuppance is so terrible, you're just like, no one deserves to drown. No one deserves to drown in cockroaches, like that kind of thing. And so, you know, you can kind of project onto that, you know, like, well, everyone knows who they are. Everyone knows what mistakes that they've made. If I went to hell, what would my ironic punishment be? We all kind of know that.
Yeah,
and so when we see that bestowed upon someone, we can say to ourselves, yeah, that's my worst nightmare. You know, that kind of thing. But in this movie, she's like, yeah, bad things happen to her, but she's also kind of weirdly untouchable, which makes it more frustrating because there's no catharsis to this. Mm-hmm. It's weirdly moralless in a very unsatisfying, vicious kind of way. It is a nails on chalkboard experience. It really is.
Is it that you can't figure out the moral, or is it that it definitely has a moral that you disapprove of?
I don't think it has a moral. That's an excellent question. That's an excellent question, and it's one where I'm gonna yield the floor a little bit because I haven't seen it very recently.
Okay.
But if memory serves, because I remember I wrote a review of this, and you can read this I wrote a review the same day I wrote it, and you can read that review on the Wrap, and it'll have a clearer. And I'm much more kind, I think, in that review than I should have been, because I'm talking about the creative process that led to this movie being so bad. And I kind of get how you got there, but I honestly feel that this movie feels like trolling.
Serve a function as well.
Perhaps, but it also depends on where it's directed, isn't it? Trolling someone in a pointed manner in order to expose hypocrisy or lies, or in order to make a cutting attempt to reveal a grander truth. That might have some value, potentially. But there's also just shitty people saying shitty things to be shitty, to get a rise out of it, so people to notice them. Mm. And that's this character, and I feel like the movie doesn't dislike her as much as I do. Mm. And I think the problem with making a movie where your protagonist is incredibly just difficult to be around is that you have to be around them the whole time.
Mm.
And I think the best you can say about this movie is that they dramatically overplayed that hand.
Huh.
The one interesting thing I think this movie does, and I feel like something to be done with this somewhere down the road, maybe, or maybe someone will do something more clever with it. But because the movie is played out like a live web stream, and if you know, it's like when you're watching like YouTube, you can watch it like live with comments.
Uh-huh.
If it was like a live show and you can see people interact or whatever, comment on things in real time. We have that for most of the movie.
Okay.
Like on the side, we see people commenting on the action. And after a while, it becomes like this kind of modern version of a Greek chorus. Mm. Where we're getting sort of interesting commentary, and like people are commenting, they don't believe what's happening, or maybe they're trying to, you know, protect her or something like that. There's like one bit I just made a mental note of it, where someone's just like, nobody ever listens to us. Like, it's basically like, it's just this weird, you know, you're kind of helpless to affect the story. There's something interesting to be done there. I think maybe you could study the film from that perspective.
That's the sort of thing that's been going on since cyber thrillers in the early 2000s. I remember seeing a thriller called My Little Eye, which came out in like 2002 or something.
Okay.
It was one of the very first movies about streaming snuff films on the internet.
Oh, yeah.
There are a couple films with that same premise. Yeah, and this was like, people are trapped in this reality show, like Big Brother type situation, and I think at like at one point they get a gun. They don't get food, but they get a gun, and now they have to. And you know, clearly, after a while, it's clear that like somebody's betting on who's gonna like live the night.
Right,
like some rich sadists are watching this on the internet, and because it's the internet in 2002, you can't trace any of it. It's completely untraceable.
Right,
Untraceable was another one.
Oh, there you go.
This sort of idea that people are watching along with something on like horrible happening on the internet is a really old idea.
Agreed.
It's a 20-year-old idea at this
point.
Agreed,
but I don't think I've ever seen it done wall to wall. Okay. I've seen it be part of a scene, perhaps, but I've never seen it just be like they are almost like MST3K. Like they're a constant presence, and we're watching them watch it. The one thing they don't really do, at least not that I could tell, was like make a consistent character about any of the commenters. That might have been interesting. If you followed along, you'll notice this person is going through this or whatever. Like, there's this weird bit in it's slightly different, but the movie Searching. Great techno thriller. Oh my god, that movie's good. If you haven't seen it, John Cho plays a dad. His like teenage daughter goes missing, and the whole movie is him searching through her computer. Like, we see it through like the camera on the computer, trying to find out more about her, like trying to like find out her browsing history, her social media history, who she was interacting with online, her emails, and finding out that he didn't really know his daughter very well. And she was actually like in into a lot of things that maybe were a problem, maybe they weren't, but it's very much a revelation to him, and he's trying to solve the mystery by solving his daughter, basically. However, if you look at the margins in that movie, if you look at, like, when he's looking at, like, a YouTube clip, if you pay attention to, like, little details, like, here's a recommended video and stuff like that, there's also aliens. There's, like, this little hidden subplot where, like, there's this weird, like, X-Files kind of thing. It doesn't directly connect to the story at all, but if you pay attention, there's just, like, a little side thing going on and, like, the other news stories that are relevant. That's kind of neat. It's kind of fun.
I actually got to write an article recently about, the extra 200 pages of script that the screenwriters needed to put together to fill in all of those extra little side margins.
Yeah. It's interesting. Anyway, so dash cam, I do not recommend it. This is one of those things where sometimes you just came out, we'll review it next week after people have had a chance to see it. You just had a chance to see the new Jurassic Park and you wrote a tweet
I just came back from seeing it tonight.
Yeah. And you can see his Twitter feed, you can see the tweet. He wrote a tweet that was like virulently like, you know, that this was not a good movie. And we'll go into great detail about it when we review it.
I didn't like it.
You did not care about it. And you said so in a very, very colorful manner. Not necessarily using bad language. It's just like, you know, you can just see like, okay, here's what's wrong with this. And then like one of the first comments was immediately, well, now I want to see it more. I'm like, no, I'm trying to spare you. In the case of Dashcam, I legitimately do not recommend you put yourself through it because it's going to really just like, It's not going to scratch an itch. It's going to make you itch.
Well, there's
I cannot in good conscience tell people. I don't know who this is for. I don't know who to recommend this to.
You and I are very frank. When we see a movie that is so so unbelievably bad or misguided, has so many weird bad ideas in it, you got to see it.
Yeah.
When we saw like Serenity, it was an example that comes to
mind. The Matthew McConaughey movie, not the sci-fi movie.
That has a twist about halfway through that is bonkers.
That is such a terrible, weird, unsatisfying, yet completely like for story-wise game-changing idea. You have to see that shit to believe they really did it.
So, Serenity, not a good film.
Yes, I do recommend it.
But, yeah, you should definitely see something like that.
Yeah, so I will flat out tell you.
We'll say that, if that's the case, if it's, like, so awful that it becomes kind of fascinating in a way.
Yeah, it's like
then we're going to tell you to go see that.
It's like watching a Dr. Pimple Popper episode. Like, this is technically gross, but I can't take my eyes off it.
The people who re-released Morbius thought that they could get traction in that regard. Yeah, like, Morbius it's fascinatingly bad. No, it is... It's just a bad movie.
It's actually very blandly bad. Yeah. It's like it's not interesting enough to develop a cult, I think. Yeah. I think it's just people are just amused by it, by its failure. I think that's why it got memed so hard. And also, Morbius is just fun to say. So when I say this, and listen, it's not our job to tell you what to see, and I would never, you know, if you want, but knock yourself out. But, like, I just don't know who to recommend this to. Like, sometimes I'll say, this movie, I didn't care for it, but if you're into this, this might be for you, and I'll fully admit that. Yeah. I don't know who this is for. It's aggravating to watch it. So I'm just going to leave it there. This is not a particularly good film. Why don't you tell me about a movie I wanted to see and I wasn't able to make the time. Tell me about Fire Island.
Fire Island is a new romantic comedy. It's on Hulu. And it is an adaptation of Pride and Prejudice, wouldn't you know it?
Ooh.
It's queer Pride and Prejudice.
Good pitch.
This is directed by Andrew Ahn.
Oh, I love Andrew Ahn.
Who did that film Driveways from last year, which is an excellent movie.
That was a great, great... Brian Dennehy giving a masterclass performance in that movie. Yeah, you have to see that movie. It's so good.
And I think it was his last performance before he died.
Or it was right up there, yeah. It's one of those things where, like, did he have one movie in the can or something? But it's definitely his swan song. It is an excellent performance. Like, he should have been nominated for an Oscar... And maybe he should have won. Like, he's really great in that film.
Yeah. Fire Island is a real place. Mm-hmm. Fire Island was notoriously, for many, many years, I'm not totally clear on the history of Fire Island.
Yeah, nor I. I've never
been
there.
But it was a gay haven for many decades. Mm-hmm. And these days in 2022, it's a place where you can go every once in a while and have sort of just like a party weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And it's part of Long Island in New York, Fire Island. And this is a story about a group of friends. They're going to go to Fire Island for a big party weekend because this is Pride and Prejudice. Mm. Our main character, the Elizabeth Bennet character, is Noah, played by an actor named Joel Kim Booster.
Okay.
And he is there to make sure that his best friend, Howie, the Jane Bennet character, is sort of hooked up with a husband, essentially.
Okay.
Or just, like, gets to have, like, a little bit of a romantic dalliance.
A partner.
Howie is a bit of a nerd, and he likes to talk about, like, comedy sketches, whereas Noah is like, no, this is, like, Lost Weekend stuff. Take a bunch of drugs, have a bunch of sex. This is what you get to have, like, all of this, a weekend of complete hedonism. Meanwhile, he starts to fall for this other fellow, the Mr. Darcy character. There's a character named Will, played by Conrad Rickamora. And he's, yeah, just like Mr. Darcy, a little bit cold, kind of intellectual, but they're really drawn to each other, even though they want to bicker a lot.
Ah, if only they didn't have so much pride and or prejudice.
Pride and the other thing. It doesn't stick to the Pride and Prejudice story too much. It's actually very much a hangout movie. There's a lot of moments where there's just these characters are just sort of hanging out, talking about their lives, talking about their love lives, talking about what they're going through, not in a dramatic way, just ways to build character. And they're staying on Fire Island with a friend of theirs, this sort of elder lesbian who has bought a house on Fire Island, played by Margaret Cho. She's like the big star of the movie.
Always good to see Margaret Cho, very talented.
You and I just saw Face Slash Off, the John Woo movie. We did a commentary track for
We'd seen it before, but we recently rewatched it together,
I had forgotten that Margaret Cho is just, like, a background character.
Yeah.
Like, she's just one of the people in the CIA office. She has nothing to do in the movie.
Yeah, she's just there.
Like, and there's Margaret Cho.
She's perfectly fine in it, but you're not making the most of Margaret Cho. She's incredibly talented. It's weird to see her in a role that doesn't particularly benefit from having Margaret Cho. But I'm glad you got the work. I bet the residuals are pretty good.
There's a joke in this movie where all of these characters, they're young, they're in their 20s, they're there to have fun, but they're not rich. And in fact, there are a lot of rich people on Fire Island, and this sort of like conflict of class is a kind of a running theme throughout the movie. How they are invited into the rich white guy's house. And these are like young Asian men, and they feel very unwelcome wherever they go. And there's a really funny bit where they're sort of gathering around Margaret Cho, and she's talking about how even though she owns a house, she also doesn't have a lot of money. And the joke is, I don't have any money. I'm terrible with money. I was an early investor in Quibi. First Quibi joke I've heard in a movie.
Yay!
It turns out this was going to be a Quibi movie. The star was developing a queer romance for Quibi.
That's hilarious.
And like, it was in development, and unfortunately, Quibi shut down after 7 months, so the project kind of scattered and regrouped a little bit and was rewritten and became this instead. Yeah, so this is kind of like a child of a Quibi project.
A lot of Quibi shows, not all weirdly enough, but a lot of Quibi shows are currently available on Roku.
Yeah, so
you can definitely see some of them, but you said before that many of them were quite good.
Some of them were bad, but
they produced like a lot of shows in a very short amount of time.
A lot of shows, and they attracted a lot of, because they spent a lot of money, so they attracted a lot of talent. They tried to get some really interesting ideas in there. Their Most Dangerous Game was kind of fun.
What was that Steve Soderbergh one where there's a guy who's like trapped in like the wilderness, and every time he looks at his phone, if you moved your phone, you could see what was on his phone.
That was wireless. That was probably the best thing Quibi did. When you watched it on your phone sideways, you could see the actors, the character.
Yeah.
But when you turned it upright, you could see whatever was on his phone at that minute. And each of the chapters, because it was split into 7-minute segments, was named after the percentage of battery life that was on his phone. So his phone is slowly running out of batteries during this thriller thing.
So
Fire Island was supposed to be a Quibi project. It turned into a feature film on Hulu. This is a very sweet movie. Because it actually deals with the characters and their desires in the way a Jane Austen novel might. And people are actually talking about their feelings, but in a relatable sort of way. And the main character is constantly translating a lot of subtext. the same way Elizabeth Bennet would. In that we, somebody says something and we get to hear his voiceover. Here's what this really means. Like, it's like, oh, you're so cute means I would never fuck you. Like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that's cute, and that's like sort of like a fun narrative device, but it also goes to show what a know-it-all that character is, and that actually kind of comes around to bite him in the ass at the end. It's also very open and frank about queer lifestyles and a lot of I haven't been to Fire Island, but a lot of sort of the foibles of what going there is like, and what it's like to cruise and have sex with or just pick up other men.
It purports to give you the flavor of the community.
Exactly. Okay, and how
accurate that is, we cannot say.
How it feels like a world removed, and how the sort of the romantic rules and the sexual rules are a little bit different on Fire Island.
All right.
And it's just really relaxed about it.
Do we ever see the fire? Is there like a big
It's not a fire island, goodness sake.
I played a lot of video games. I've been to a lot of fire islands. I've been to a lot of water islands. Yeah. I guess they're all water islands. Yeah, if you really think about it. Sometimes I don't have a lot to contribute
world,
when Whitney
grass
hasn't
world,
seen
ocean
the,
world.
I haven't seen the movie Whitney saw.
No, I really dug it. This is just nice. A really sweet queer romance. It feels really reminiscent of a lot of things I saw in the 1990s, where... In the 90s, there was this sort of boom in independent queer cinema. There was a lot of new queer movies were coming out all the time.
Yeah.
From Watermelon Woman on down. And there was... A lot of these movies weren't necessarily all that good.
Not necessarily.
I saw a movie called Kiss Me Guido once that came out during that phase... which is just terrible.
It's not a good movie. I remember... Kiss Me Guido is a movie... So fucking stupid. It is about a very stereotypical sitcom Italian-American guy whose girlfriend breaks up with them, and he moves in with the gay guy, and they're not going to get along.
Well,
different.
The joke is he doesn't know he doesn't read that this is a gay man.
In fact, when he reads the ad saying, GWM
seeks
GWM roommate, he thinks GWM means guy with money. Yeah. So, like, let me give you an example of this.
TV seeking partner. So, what he's got a TV?
Let me give you the best example of humor in this movie. This is a joke that made my parents laugh.
Oh no!
It is a harmless joke.
Okay.
It is a harmless. It's a little stereotypical about Italian Americans. But speaking as an Italian American, I can handle this one. There's a bit where he's got to move out of his girlfriend's apartment. She's cheating on him, and he's got to move out right away. And he tells his best friend, who works at a pizza place because they're Italian, bring some boxes so that I can move my stuff. And he brings a bunch of
pizza
boxes.
I remember that guy.
Yeah, and it's that kind of like... I see how that's a joke. I honestly don't see how a person would do that. Like an adult person would think that these are useful moving boxes.
Unless you're moving a lot of pizzas.
Again, if you're moving pizzas, yes. If you're moving anything else, not maybe vinyl records? Like, I don't understand. Like, they're not useful. That's the level of humor we're talking about here. Like, that's how good it was.
The point I'm going to make about Kiss Me Guido, and there are other examples as well. Better Than Chocolate's okay. Jeffrey is okay. But these were queer movies that came out at a time when... the filmmakers assumed that the characters were interesting merely because they were queer.
Okay.
They didn't seem to have too much character at all. Like, their sexuality was their character, and that was it. And then we were... because that was considered kind of novel at the time, audiences were expected just to glom onto that. It's like, well, no. Can we have, like, story and character as well, and not just have a character say, I am queer?
And again, to be clear, there were really good movies, too. But there were also some movies that seemed to coast.
And...
Yeah.
I'm grateful that we were kind of moving past that. I saw a film more recently called Love, Simon.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which was a teenage high school queer romance.
And indeed, it was a studio rom-com.
Studio romantic comedy.
It was like a
queer
John Hughes type movie. Yeah.
Big cheer moment when two boys kiss.
Yeah.
Wonderful idea.
Sweet film.
Simon is boring as shit.
Yes, he is.
He's a really boring character.
He's a generic John Hughes hero. Yeah.
And again, so I got a little bit of whiff of that the character we're supposed to find him interesting merely because he's queer. And it would have been nice if he had some personality or foibles or something beyond that.
Sure.
I started up Fire Island and it started to feel that way for a second.
Okay.
It's like, oh no.
Here we go.
You're not going to have any character. Oh, wait. Really quickly, they dispel all of that. And all of these characters, even the minor characters, have really weird personality traits. They're all these sort of like quirky sitcom type characters. It's a little broad.
It's a comedy.
But they all have texture, and that's really nice.
That's great.
And, you know, people drift in and out. One of the characters is a little bit secretive. It turns out he's secretive because he has an OnlyFans. so that's his big secret. And, okay. Yeah, that's sort of like the modern version of like a Jane Austen secret, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's like, I'm
secretly writing a novel.
Yeah, like I'm
oh God,
wild artist who's writing a novel on the side.
Yes.
Yeah. What's the modern version of that? What's something you could do to make money and to be creative, but you wouldn't want to tell anybody on a first date?
It's yeah, like, yeah,
oh,
yeah.
I have an OnlyFans.
I can see that. All
those little details lend to a lot of texture. And like I said, there's a lot of scenes where people are just sort of hanging out and just sort of talking. And I love that kind of thing, that the hangout movie where we get to know people just through their conversations.
Yeah.
So it's really, really quite good.
Sounds good.
Really,
this is on Hulu. Sweet.
This is on Hulu.
Okay, I'm definitely going to check this out. I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to see it in time, but it sounds really, really good. A lot of the things you were saying about this movie and how it reminded you, in positive and negative ways, about like movies from the 90s. Something I can say about the next film that I saw that you didn't see The Interceptor?
I did not see Interceptor.
Okay, so I saw this it's a new Netflix movie, Interceptor, but whereas something like, say, Fire Island evokes the queer indie boom of the 90s, remember when Jean-Claude Van Damme would release like kind of shitty action movies, but they'd go into theaters?
Yeah, Hard Target's pretty good.
The Hard Target's pretty good, but I'm talking about like the kind of shitty ones. You know, like the ones that are like barely a movie. Yeah, like kind of barely a movie. Like, yeah, okay, so.
A knockoff is a Choi Hark film, too.
I know, and Choi Hark is like a huge deal in China, and when he came to America, they gave him nothing good to work with.
He also
did
like Double Team or some of the other garbage, American garbage movies.
John Woo got a lot of like really plum projects in Hollywood, but when a lot of other filmmakers from Hong Kong came over here, Hollywood just did him dirty. Like Ringo Lam, Hollywood was like mean to the career of Ringo Lam. Like they just didn't know what to do with him. So that's not my point. My point is this. There is a certain breed of action movie that is trying to thrill you, but not spend a lot of money. And not like really go overboard about it. Like it just
that's a thing.
And I actually want to say, and this is not a bad thing. Okay? Not every movie is trying to blow your goddamn mind. Sometimes they're just trying to be a good time. And I have a lot of respect for people who make low-budget action movies. Oftentimes these are things that would go straight to video or straight to streaming. And I'm not talking about like the high-profile Netflix stuff. I'm talking like we're doing a straight-to-video sequel to Scorpion King. Like that kind of like we're going to have a good time here, but like we're not pretending this is going to be especially good.
We don't have, like, expensive sets. We're going to shoot out in the desert of California.
Yeah.
We have a few horses.
Yeah. We have a couple of actors that you recognize, but no one especially famous.
And that
and the script
works,
is just okay.
That works if you have a talented fighter and or stunt coordinator.
Especially then. That really, really helps. But even then, what really, honestly, you can do it if you have a fun script that isn't trying to be bigger than it is. You don't want a script that is trying to give you a whole bunch of stuff that you cannot afford to film. You don't want a script that would only work in a larger context if like you had really cool looking dinosaurs in it or something. Mm. You want something that is modest, but within that modest framework is trying to give you suspense and excitement and thrills. And that's Interceptor. It is a low budget. It's either like really, 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 really high end Asylum or really, really, really low end Jean-Claude Van Damme. Like it's somewhere in that weird, like that half inch of space between those two things.
I'll say that there are plenty of entertaining movies in that space.
And this is one of them.
Okay.
Interceptor. Glad to hear. Interceptor is a film written and directed by Matthew Riley. It is co-written by Stuart Beatty, who is one of those screenwriters who has a very up and down career. In addition to working on things like Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl, and Collateral and 30 Days of Night. Right. He's also done stuff like G.I. Joe The Rise of Cobra and Derailed, and he directed I, Frankenstein. So, a lot of ups and downs.
Yeah.
Recently, if you might recognize the name, he's written or co-written a lot of episodes of that new Obi-Wan Kenobi series on Disney. So he's got a bit of an upswing. Good for him. In any case, this movie stars Elsa Pataky. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. It's a Spanish actress who is perhaps best known as a character from the Fast and Furious movie. She was introduced as the Brazilian cop Dwayne Johnson takes under his wing in Fast Five. And then later on, she, marries Vin Diesel for, a movie and has his kid. Okay. She's kind of written out of the series unceremoniously. But here she's the action movie star. She plays an American, soldier. I think she's in the Army. Not a Marine. Who is stationed on, and the movie assures us that this is a thing. I have no idea how true this is, but the idea is this. If the Russians ever sent nuclear missiles to the United States from the West Coast, or the East Coast of Russia, but the West Coast of America, there are only two places where we have missiles set up to intercept them.
Okay.
One is in Alaska, and one is on a standalone, oil derrick in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean.
All right.
That's the premise. At the beginning of the movie, bad guys have...
In the middle of the Atlantic.
What did I say?
You said Atlantic.
I meant the Pacific, sorry.
Okay.
But does that be... That's just
a... That's a long trip for a Russian missile to make 12, the United
States. It's 12:43 a.m. and, right. and I just mixed it up. Honest mistake. So at the beginning of the movie, bad guys have overtaken the Alaskan outpost. And now they're going to try to overtake this, oil derrick outpost so that America will be defenseless against nuclear missiles to destroy the country. And the only person standing in their way is Elsa Pataky. Hmm. Elsa Pataky is actually a pretty convincing action star. You know, she fights good. She acts okay. This is why I bring in Jean-Claude Van Damme. I'm convinced that she can kick my butt and look good doing it. But I'm not gonna hire her to do Shakespeare right now. I don't think there's not a lot of nuance to the performance. And the other reason I bring up Jean-Claude Van Damme is if you recall, a lot of Jean-Claude Van Damme films would cast Jean-Claude Van Damme in a role that was sort of quintessentially American, but then they'd have to explain his accent. Mm. Oh yes, but he was raised on the bayou, that kind of thing. There's a great bit at the beginning of this movie where Elsa Pataky is stationed at this interceptor base. And someone greets her. It's like, yes, welcome, Captain. Welcome to the Interceptor base. I will show you to your quarters. And then clearly ADR, clearly added in post, someone says off camera, so I hear you were raised in Spain.
I love it.
Just to hide that she's got a very thick Spanish accent, which is not really a problem, but I love the very half-hearted attempt to explain it. It's so on the nose. It's great. So anyway, bad guys, they've intercepted the place. They've, taken the place of, the janitorial staff. And now they're ready to kill everybody. And at the beginning of the movie, they kill everyone except for her and, one other guy. And they've barricaded themselves in the room with all the computer equipment that controls the missiles. And all they want to do is destroy the computer equipment. And it's just two people in a room trying to stop really, heavily armed bad guys from breaking in. And if they do, they'll destroy all of America.
Okay.
Which is a good, solid premise for a low-budget action movie. Gigantic stakes. Huge stakes. People in a room, people in a hallway. That's the movie. And I love it. I love that. It's so clean. The movie kicks into high gear within 10 minutes. We're not fucking around here. She shows up at the base. There's a little bit of exposition about who she is and what she came from and why she's got such a crappy position, even though she's such a badass. And then within 10 minutes, her boss has been shot in the head and she's barricaded in there. And that's the rest of the movie.
That's great.
Yeah. And then occasionally...
Just get cut to it.
It's so efficient. I can't be mad at that.
Is this movie any longer than 85 minutes?
I think it's 90 on the dot. It's pretty clear. It's an hour and 39, but it feels tight.
All right.
It feels tight.
They managed to find that's dragging.
Here's what I'll say. It's not always clever, but they managed to find a way to never let that get too dull. There's always just like, okay, we've done some exposition here. We now know who the bad guy is and what's going on. And, oh no, a martial artist has just dropped in through an air vent. Well, I guess we got to deal with this right now. It's awesome.
Is that Don the Dragon Wilson?
I wish it was. That would have been amazing. If that had been a get, that would have been cool. Like, but it's just a random guy. We never even saw him before in the movie. He just sort of shows up. That's the whole fucking movie. It's her being a badass, and she's reasonably convincing at it. Mm. The bad guy being a smarmy asshole. They play the bad guy as if he's like Donald Trump Jr. Like, the whole idea is like his dad is like some really rich guy who became a politician, even though he's an idiot and an amoral asshole, and that's his backstory. That's why he hates America or some shit like that. That's it. That's the whole fucking movie. It is reasonably low budget. There's a couple of like bits where they exit the room, and it looks reasonably convincing that they're on like an oil derrick kind of thing. But yeah, clean, simple, suspenseful. You know, you can only take it too seriously, but I think the movie is aware that it's not like Shakespeare. Like, it's just. It's a very modest action movie that is never trying to be bigger than it is, and it's got a decent setup for it. And honestly, Elsa Pataky, yeah, you want to do some more action? Let's do some more action movies, man. Let's get you like your own like. let's say you be the next JCVD. Why not? You're kind of badass. Let's do it.
Get a Rothrock back in the.
Why not? They're cool. Honestly, I dig them so. Yeah, again, if you keep your expectations of the movie modest, if you are going in expecting this is a low budget action movie and not one that's like trying, it's not like John Wick 1, where it technically didn't cost that much, but they got a lot of bang for out of it.
Yeah.
Like, no. This is a low budget action movie. Keep that in mind. You'll have a good time.
Mm.
That's all I'll say. However, I have heard rave reviews. Of the movie you saw that I didn't because I didn't have 3 extra hours this week.
Yeah, if you want the exact opposite of modest action. if you want your cup to runneth over with action, then you can see Triple R, which is an Indian film from a star director. His name is S.S. Rajamouli, who works in Telugu cinema. Which is an industry unto itself. Telugu and Tamil movies are not to be confused with Bollywood movies. Bollywood is a completely different industry. Bollywood is Bombay films. It's a Telugu film. And the only way I was able to see it was in Hindi. It was dubbed into Hindi and also English on Netflix. That's the way they offer it.
I'm not exactly sure. It's right there. Yeah. You have that.
It's a Telugu language film, but it's the version I saw was in Hindi.
Yeah. Maybe they can only do 2 language offerings per film?
I'm not sure. There's got to be some weird availability problem.
So annoying. That's the other reason I wasn't excited to watch it. I was hoping to see it in the original language.
This is the story of 2 real-life Indian freedom fighters. It takes place in India in the 1920s, and the 2 main characters are Komaram Bheem, who's played by N.T. Rama Rao Jr., and Alluri Sitarama Raju. Raju is played by Ram Charan. Ram Charan, handsome as fuck, has, like, the sweetest, like, Luigi Nintendo mustache you've ever seen. Like this resplendent mustache. And these are 2 actual Indian freedom fighters who never actually met in real life. But this is like sort of like a historical revisionism thing where what would happen if these 2 guys actually met and became best friends?
I'm down for that.
It'd be like, what if like Lincoln and Napoleon, well, I guess Lincoln and Napoleon aren't.
They weren't contemporaries.
But yeah.
Like, yeah. What if Thomas Jefferson and Napoleon fought aliens?
Oh, maybe not aliens, but they teamed up to like just be badasses together.
Yeah, I don't know.
So the plot of the movie is the Bheem character. These horrible British colonialists have visited his remote village and they've paid this 13-year-old girl to sort of sing for them, and they give a bunch of money. It's like, oh, this is great. Why don't we just buy her? And they throw a few coins at the villagers, and they drive off. They kidnap the daughter. The colonialists are played by Ray Stevenson and Allison Duty. Allison Duty from Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. That's what I know her from.
She was also in A View to a Kill. She played Jenny Flex.
That's right.
Which is not a great Bond girl name, but okay. Yeah.
So Beam goes to Delhi to look for her. He knows that she's sort of in one of these big mansions, but needs to sort of locate her. Meanwhile, we're introduced to the Raju character in this big ol' action set piece where local consulate, the British consulate, is being beset by rioters.
Yeah.
And one guy throws a rock and insults the British white nationalist dude. And he just says, hey, who was that? That one guy in this like crowd of hundreds. Arrest him. And Raju becomes like, he becomes Riddick in that moment. Like he bounds over the fence and just like with a stick, just murders 40 people on the way out to like apprehend this one guy, pick him up, jump over the fence with him. It's like this 15-minute set piece that the movie just opens with. It's before we've even got the title of the thing. And eventually he is hired to track down the people who might be looking for the kidnapped girl. So they've never met, they've never seen each other. They run into each other in Delhi, and through another action set piece where they rescue a boy from a train that might fall on him from a bridge using like this really elaborate rope maneuver.
Okay.
They bond and they become best friends and they sing about it because this is an Indian film and you're not going to go through an Indian film without getting at least a few musical bangers.
Yeah.
A lot of pop stars come to prominence because of their musical talents in these gigantic action. It doesn't really matter what the genre is.
Yeah.
It could be a romance, well, could be a comedy, could be an action picture. There's going to be some musical set.
Not every country or culture has the same idea of genre rigidity that Americans do, where you're only allowed to break into a song if you're a musical or maybe if you're a comedy. But there's a lot of other countries that are just like, you can switch between wildly different genres more naturally, and people don't say like, hey, pick a lane. It's accepted that you can do anything.
What I appreciate about Indian cinema, at least the Indian cinema that I've seen, is they're going to entertain you, damn it. You're in there, if you're going to go to the bother of paying money to see a movie, they're going to give you a lot of it. It's going to be at least 3 hours in length. And it's going to have action set pieces, there's going to be a romance, there's going to be songs. They're going to give you everything in every movie. I feel like some of the superhero movies are trying to go in that direction in America now.
Yeah, we got to have a gigantic motion picture like experience.
Like Avengers Endgame has this ending set piece. It's like 30 minutes and 50 characters, and they're all fighting each other. They could sing in that number. I don't know why they didn't sing.
Remember that one episode of The Simpsons where Monty Burns went over to the Simpsons house to watch boxing, and he was like, back in my day, if they didn't go at least 50 rounds, we'd ask for our nickel back. Like, that's... You were expected to get a lot of entertainment for your money.
Yeah. So we get to see their friendship grow. Oh no, will they find out that one of them is actually on the run from the other one? You know, are they going to find out that he's a cop? Maybe he knows he's a cop, but he's looking for somebody else. All of these little bits of misunderstandings. Of course, the truth comes to light, and it leads to... But before that, they kind of bond a little bit, and they go to a big fancy dress ball, and they outdance the British, and there's this gigantic, amazing dance number. All of this will lead to a great siege on the British consulate, where the Beam character has a truck full of animals that he's specially, he hasn't specially trained, they're just sort of feral animals. He lets out a bunch of tigers, and they're just savaging everyone as he's this hunky shirtless guy trying to break into a building and stuff's on fire. And then the intermission comes. And then there's another movie worth of action to go. We get a flashback to the Raju character and what he's been doing this whole time and how he believes in guns and how he had to fight off British soldiers when he was a child. this movie doesn't stop for a second. It's just breakneck all the way through. The word people have been using to describe it is maximalist. It's maximalist entertainment. I feel like that's true of a lot of Indian cinema. Just they're going to put a lot of it in there. I don't know why this one in particular is striking, but I'm glad it is because it is really entertaining.
Is it a movie
that's going to give you the slickest, most amazing, kind of ridiculous action that you kind of wished was in all of the summer blockbusters. This is the kind... We talked about this when we talked about Top Gun as well. Yeah. We feel like action movies probably should all be kind of this slick, right? Especially the big studio ones that have a lot of money behind them.
Yeah, you want...
I think they would have put a lot of thought and structure and energy into making it as efficient as possible.
Yeah, we don't want them all to be the same, but we want them to be efficient and well-told.
Exactly,
yeah.
I don't want them all to be, you know, about pilots. That's not what I'm saying. And we talked about when we reviewed the new Doctor Strange movie, how that movie feels... like weirdly haphazard and a little bit shabby, which is weird for a movie of its cost.
It doesn't feel like it's particularly well structured or very clear in its intentions.
Yeah.
It's a fucking mess is what it is. It's an enjoyable mess in a lot of ways, but it is a mess.
There's plenty of enjoyable stuff in there. Yeah. And, you know, the zombie stuff is really fun in that movie, but you would think that every summer blockbuster, like it would be their birthright to be as entertaining as something like Top Gun. I'm not a huge fan of Top Gun, but I recognize it for, like, the near-perfect summer blockbuster machine that it is.
Sure. You don't have to love that, but you see what it's doing. Yeah. You understand why people are digging it.
Triple R has a similar sort of thing that we all long for, and that's we want all of this entertainment. We want all of this backstory. We thirst for it. And we want to see... a movie that is completely unguarded in how forthrightly emotional it is. Nothing's cool in this movie. Everybody feels everything very intensely. Everything's intense in this movie. Everything's ratcheted up, including stuff like friendship and romances.
Yeah.
There's no action movie filter to this. It's all very earnest.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big reason why a lot of people are in... at least the American audiences are responding to it the way they are.
My one question about this, because it sounds fun, I'm definitely going to watch this. You talk about how it's just like, it never stops. There's always more amazing shit being thrown at the screen. But we've also talked before about how a lot of movies are trying to do something similar. They're trying to be just wall-to-wall cool stuff. But sometimes the pacing is a problem because it gets exhausting after a while. This is a three-hour maximalist movie. Does it ever feel like too much?
No. I don't want to... I say there's a lot in it, but I don't want to imply that there's, like, pacing problems. It's not like something like The Raid, where it's just action all from beginning to end.
Yeah, which, and again, a lot of respect to that movie, but it's a little exhausting after a while.
This is a very, very well-modulated film. There's, like I said, there's, like, dance numbers and musical numbers and you know, love stories and backstories, so it actually does ebb and flow the way a movie ought to.
Okay.
It's just everything's so much, is, like, turned up a little bit louder.
Okay.
Everything's a little bit higher. And so, no, it doesn't become exhausting. It's actually really propulsive and really kind of gets you through.
Well, that sounds awesome.
I mean, there's a lot of, you know, and same with the superhero movies. People are just sitting through these three-hour movies.
Yeah.
It's like the length is a problem. Well, I don't hear a lot of people saying that about Batman or Avengers.
Well, I said that about the Batman, but I didn't say that, even though I'm not as in love with it as other people are. Avengers Endgame? That's a lot of movie.
That is a lot of movie.
That's a lot. You got your money's worth with that movie. Even if you, whether you loved it or just liked it, that's a ton of movie.
I wanted my dream cut of the movie would be none of the time travel stuff.
Just skip it all.
They
disappear and they just come back. We did it.
Yeah, disappear, zip, pop, they're just back. And they have the gems. Black Widow's gone, and it's just like, oh shit, she's gone. What happened? I can't tell you about it. It's so awful. Like that would have been. Yeah.
And then we could release like a spin-off movie that just shows what happened.
Sure, why not? Just milk it even further. Why not?
That's not a bad idea. Actually.
Like it's like, oh no, now we have to get more. What were the
Infinity Stones?
No, the widgets that let them like time travel more.
Pym particles.
Pym particles. We have to go in and get more Pym. Skip all that shit. We don't need it. Captain America fighting himself. We don't need one Captain America is bad enough. We don't need two of them.
Oh, Okay, we're going to move on. We're getting into the weeds. All right, so that is it for the new movie reviews. Let's look back at everything we talked about, and let's judge everything on the critically acclaimed scale. Now, once again, for those who may be new or need a refresher, here's how the critically acclaimed scale works, and it's different from other scales. We review movies on a scale of C- to C+. The lowest a movie can get is a C-. That's anything that's below average.
Yeah.
That's just anything. We just kind of just don't recommend it. It could be terrible. It could just not be particularly good. That's a C-. C is average. You know, it's just kind of okay, or there's some good, some bad, some audiences will like it more than others. That's a C. Mm-hmm. And then C+ is anything above average. Anything we just genuinely recommend, either because it's just kind of neat, or it's, like, really unbelievably amazing. So on that note, Whitney, how do you rate RRR?
It's a C+.
Nice.
It's really excellent. I saw it not in Telugu, but you know, it's. I'll probably try to watch it again. This has been getting a few limited theatrical runs, at least here in Los Angeles, and I think in New York as well. It's not nationwide release, but because it's on Netflix now, you can just watch it.
So, if you do get a chance to see it theatrically, look into your theater, because I've heard a couple of places, because the movie is so long and a lot of like contemporary like projectionists don't understand the concept of intermissions. Mm. We've heard some stories about some movies cutting it off in intermission.
The theater would just stop at intermission.
Yeah, and they just stop the movie. You don't get to see the second half. I remember that kind of happened like once or twice with Grindhouse, I heard, or something similar. But in any case, so look into that if you're going to go see it in a theater. But it is on Netflix. But it is not in the original language, which is weird.
Hmm.
But anyway, next up we have Interceptor, which is also on Netflix. Interceptor is a very high C. It's not quite exciting and thrilling and awesome enough to warrant like an unabashed recommendation.
Hmm.
But for what it is, if you want to like take a course in like how to make a lot out of kind of a little, without like necessarily relying entirely on like, well, we've got like these amazing martial artists and we'll just let them do what they do. It's like, no, we don't really have that. We just, you know, have a decent idea that doesn't cost a lot of money, and we're not going to throw a lot of money at it, and our cast isn't amazing, but they're going to do their jobs, and we're going to see how good movie you can make. This is about as good a movie as you can make. It's quite good. So it's worth checking out if you like low-budget action movies. If you don't, well, this isn't going to convert you or anything like that, but I think you'll see that it's pretty well done. Next up, we've got Fire Island.
Also a C+.
Nice.
It's a very, very sweet, very earnest romantic comedy. Sweet, sweet, sweet. It's just the only word I want to use to describe it.
Awesome. Dash Cam is a C-. It is like a legitimately painful to watch motion picture. I have no intention of watching it again. And I honestly don't know who it's for. I don't know who to recommend this to. If you want to go experience a gauntlet, you know, you want... I've said this before, being a film critic. I've said it before, being a film critic is a full contact sport. You know, I've had this conversation with someone recently. We were talking about like, this movie's bad. And I'm like, but you enjoy watching it. Mm. And they're like, yeah, well then how bad can it really be? When I say a movie is bad, not like, oh, it's pretty bad. Like, no, when I say a movie is bad, I mean it's hard to watch. And that's Dash Cam.
And there's something to be said when you recognize that a movie is bad. Like, it's badly written, you don't like the plot, but there's an element about it that is either appealing to you or that maybe it contains an interesting idea.
When that happens, I tend to prefer to use the word incompetent.
Yeah.
Like, it's not competently done, but there's something here I'm connecting to.
Yeah.
You know, something usually something earnest, sometimes something ironic, I don't know. Moving on. Next up, we have Watcher, the new thriller starring Micah Monroe. It's a very low C+. It's not quite thrilling enough for me to go like, wow, you gotta go see it. But like, it is definitely doing exactly what it sets out to do. There's definitely some creepy moments in it. It's a good, strong character piece from Micah Monroe. And
sounds really good.
It's very, very good. It's maybe a little dry for its own good, but it is still doing everything it sets out to do. And the last shot is sticking with me, I gotta say. I think I nailed it. And then lastly, Crimes of the Future.
It's always a cause célèbre when a filmmaker like David Cronenberg makes a new one. But as you heard us whinge, it is a little bit too oblique for its own good.
Mm.
It does kind of lose the thread. I'm going to give it a C, because there is a lot of fascinating things in it. There's a lot of interesting and disturbing images.
Mm-hmm.
I just wish it cohered in a more cogent way.
I'm actually going to give this movie a C-. All right. It's not a particularly like I'm not upset with the movie per se. I'm a little disappointed in it because I know David Cronenberg has done better, but it's one where I think David Cronenberg fans might be able to find something to enjoy here, but it just doesn't really function very well as a film. It feels like a smattering of ideas that aren't developed very well and don't end up going in a direction that makes even thematic sense necessarily for the material. It just kind of gets lost in its own, plot and loses its point. There's things I like in it, but I can't really in good conscience say this is a good Cronenberg movie. Right. But anyway, that is it for Critically Acclaimed this week. Next week, we'll be back with a full review of Jurassic Park Dominions. I thought that would be funny to say. It's not. True. It's just
Dominions.
I don't know. I was going to say Dem Onions. You know, like, you know, Dem Onions, those onions.
Jurassic World Dominion, and I don't think there's a colon. It's one of the only cases I can think of other than Batman where the title is not being used in any of the advertising.
They're just saying Dominion?
No, it's just showing it's the big logo. Jurassic logo, and sometimes it's the logo with, like, the cast sort of painted inside of it. They're not...
We know what you mean. Like, everyone knows what that is.
But
no one's confused.
But it's like when Prince changed his name to a symbol. How do you pronounce that?
Well, Prince didn't... Well, here's the difference is that we know how to pronounce it. It's called Jurassic Park and or World. It's fine. Like, Jurassic Park didn't change its name. Hmm. It's just relying on a logo. I think it's
In that case, fine. I'm calling it Morbius.
There you go. Great.
The title of the movie is now Morbius. Yeah.
And other things are opening next week as well, and we'll review those too. So thank you everybody for listening. Thank you everybody for joining us. Please subscribe if you haven't already. That would be awesome. Leave us a review if you haven't already. That would also be really, really great for us. Even if you don't like it. Be honest, but reviews help us find an audience. That would be really great. If you want to discuss anything we discussed in this episode, you want to talk about any topic, you want to ask us questions, you want anything at all, you can email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We might read your email in an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail. Whitney, what is our P.O. box? We prefer the old-fashioned way.
Send us an actual physical letter to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah, we're on Twitter, @CriticAcclaim. I am @LynnDeBiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibold.
If you want more of our shows, you can head on over to Patreon. That's patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork for a lot of exclusive programs. You can vote for future episodes of our shows and get shows dedicated to the Academy Awards, Star Trek, Batman. We do commentary tracks. We do trivia nights with our patrons. It's a whole lot of stuff, and we're incredibly grateful to all of our patrons, without whom this show would not exist. And if you don't like hearing commercials on your podcast, we totally sympathize. You can listen to these podcasts ad-free at any Patreon level, even $1 a month. So thank you to all of our patrons once again. Thank you to everybody for listening. Hope you have a great week. Never forget, everyone's a critic.
I wanna go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?